Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Homage to the blessed one, the worthy one, the supremely enlightened one. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So I heard recently you've been learning about the different realms of rebirth, especially the heavenly realms. So tonight we're going to listen to a discussion between the Buddha and a heavenly being. So this being is of a type called a yakka. So in English, sometimes we say a demon. It's a heavenly being that usually has some connection with the earth, some very directly, some more indirectly. So this particular yakka, his home was on the earth. And we know quite a bit about this particular yakka and the background of this this discussion that we'll hear about tonight. We can find it in the commentaries. When the arahants got together after the Buddha passed away, they decided what would be collected in the Sutta Pitaka, the basket of teachings. And those things that they thought were not as important, they didn't include. So many times we know exactly about a discussion that happened between the Buddha and someone else, and we have kind of different sorts of details about the background as to why it happened. So the discussion that we have recorded in the Sutta Pitaka is the core of the teaching, and the background is really interesting. So it's very famous. A lot of people have heard about it. So this particular yakka is known as Alavaka, and he had been living in the in the town of Alavi, in a kingdom also known as Alavi. And he had this long-standing agreement with the king and previous kings that he would only eat those human beings that crossed underneath the tree in front of his house. So it provided a bit of stability in the kingdom, that people knew that this yakka wasn't going everywhere, and as long as you stayed away from the tree, you'd be safe. So they found a balance, which is what the king is supposed to do, I guess. So this whole situation came about because the current king in Alavi liked to go on hunting expeditions. Clearly he wasn't a disciple of the Buddha, or at least not a very good one. And so he went out hunting quite a bit, and once he got separated from his hunting party and caught a deer, and maybe somehow in his excitement he wasn't really paying attention, and he found himself under the tree of this yakka. And the yakka said, "Aha, now I get to eat you." And the king said, "Oh, no. You don't want to eat me. That's not a good idea." The yakka said, "Oh, yes. You're under my tree. This is part of the deal. I only get the people under my tree." And I guess the king tried to give the deer that he caught, and that wasn't really enough. The yaka knew that, right, he had the upper hand, that he's got the king here. So he made the king promise to actually deliver a person every day to the tree. And then he would let the king go. And if the king ever stopped doing that, then the yaka, Alawaka, would feel that his whole deal was broken, and he'd go around eating whoever he wanted. So the king, just happy to get away, went back to the palace and explained to his advisors what had happened. And the advisors said, "Well, you set a time limit on that, right?" And he said, the king said, "Oh no, I didn't know about doing that." And they said, "Oh no, when you make these deals with a yaka, something like that, you got to set a time limit. They don't tell you that you can do that, but you got to set a time limit." So it's also good to learn these stories, because then we know how to negotiate with yakas if we find ourselves in that position. If it's a promise, make it time limited. You know, for the next week, I'll send somebody, which would have been a nice deal for the yaka anyway. So the king said, "Okay, well, let's start with the criminals that are going to be executed, and let's work with them and see if we can't just keep things okay by sending a criminal every day." So the king started to do that, and day one it was okay, day two okay, but after some time, no more criminals. And word got around that if you were a criminal, sooner rather than later, you'd get fed to the yaka. So people suddenly became very virtuous in town. And the king even tried to, like, leave some jewelry laying out in the middle of the street, like, and, you know, watching to catch. And people didn't touch it. They were so afraid, they didn't even touch the jewelry laying in the middle of the street. So then the king had the idea, okay, well, let's send the old people, because they're going to die soon anyway, so let's send the old people. So the minister said, no, that won't work, because everybody loves their, you know, their grandmother and their grandfather, their old parents. They'll never agree to that. But maybe since they don't have as much attachment for their newborns, we could get away with sending the newborns. So, I mean, that's interesting, because it shows how, you know, in the culture of the day, when the Buddha was alive, people valued elders so much more, right? You know, many Western cultures, like when there's a new baby, like the baby becomes the center of the universe for the family. But in cultures like when the Supreme Buddha was alive, you know, the elders were the center of the family, and they were the keepers of knowledge and wisdom, and knew what, you know, knew how to handle different situations because they'd been alive for so long. So the king decided to go for the infant option. And that only worked to a limited degree, because the mothers would leave town as soon as they gave birth to a child, because they of course, cared very much about their infants. So the years went by, and eventually there were no criminals, there were and no infants, no children, except for the king's son, the prince. So it happened that on the day that the prince was about to be taken to Alawaka, the Supreme Buddha, in his morning meditation, would often, using his psychic powers, using his divine eye, see if there was anyone in the vicinity that had the potential to attain enlightenment, had the potential to understand the Dhamma, that the conditions were ripe in their mind, even when it wouldn't be necessarily obvious to other people. So this particular morning, the Buddha saw that, incredibly, both the mind of the yakka and the potential of this infant, and even the potential of a huge number of people in the kingdom, was there to attain the first stage of enlightenment. So he decided that that at this point he would intervene and go and teach the yakka. So the night before, this alavaka, the yakka, was away on some business, and the Buddha went to his palace, to his home, and asked if he could hang out, asked if he could find shelter there. And the lesser yakka that was guarding the door said, "Well, it's not really a problem, but you know, there's this alavaka that lives here, and he's not very nice, and he won't be happy with it. But as far as I'm concerned, you can." And so the Buddha says, "Okay, don't you worry about that yakka, I'll be all right." And of course, word got to alavaka, and he got very angry that someone was so bold, not only to come under his tree, but to sit in his palace. And even the Buddha started preaching to the, like the harem or the other yakkas that hung out in this palace. And so alavaka was really, really angry. And the legend is that he actually, using psychic powers, tried to attack the Buddha from a distance. But none of that worked. None of that worked. And so alavaka came back. And that's where the sutta picks up. So it begins, "Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Alavi, in the abode of Yakka Alavaka. Then the Yakka Alavaka approached the Blessed One and said to him, 'Get out, ascetic.' 'All right, friend,' the Blessed One said, and he went out." So Alavaka, realizing that his evil psychic powers hadn't been able to harm the Buddha, so he just orders him out of the palace. And the Buddha says, "Okay, I'll go out." And the legends say that the Buddha understood that, and we don't even need the legends to tell us this, but that the Buddha understood the different nature of people and how you need to talk to people differently in different situations when their mind is in a certain way, and that in the suttas we find this simile of an angry dog getting even more angry when you sprinkle bile, so stomach juices, on its nose. So the Buddha thought, okay, this yakka's already upset, he's already angry. If I confront him directly, like the Buddha would do sometimes, he'll just get more angry. So the Buddha just said, "Okay, I'll go," and he went out. So this, of course, didn't make Alavaka calm, and he stayed angry, and he said to the Buddha, "Okay, come back in." And the Buddha said, "Okay, friend." We have this in the sutta. "All right, friend," the Blessed One said, and he went in. A second time, Alavaka the yakka said, "Get out, ascetic." And a second time, the Supreme Buddha said, "Okay, friend, I'll go out." And a second time, Alavaka said, "Get back in there." And the Buddha said, "Okay, No problem, I'll go back in, friend. And Alavaka said, okay, well now get out. And the Buddha said, okay. And again, Alavaka said, get back in. Right, because Alavaka, he knew that he couldn't physically harm him, but he thought that maybe if he could make him angry, ordering him in and out, that maybe that would provoke him and somehow diminish the Buddha's spiritual powers. We don't know for sure what he was thinking. But, and so a fourth time, Alavaka said, get out. And that's when the Buddha said, No, I'm not going to do this anymore. You can do whatever you like, but I'm not leaving this time. Do whatever you have to do. And so Alavaka responded. He said, I'll ask you a question, ascetic. If you won't answer me, I'll drive you insane or split your heart or grab you by the feet and hurl you across the Ganges River. So, he makes this threat. I'm going to ask you a question, and if you don't answer it, I'm going to kill you, throw you across the Ganges River. So then the Buddha replies. He says, I do not see anyone in this world, friend, with its devas, Mara, and Brahma, in this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its devas and humans, who could drive me insane or split my heart or grab me by the feet and hurl me across the Ganges. So, this is one of the qualities of a Buddha. So, we know, we've learned lots and lots of things about karma and its results. And that when we protect others, when we don't kill, when we don't harm others, then through that good karma, it can ripen, especially in the human world, as having good health. Strength, right? So one of the qualities of a Sammasambuddha is that they can't be killed. No matter what is done to them, in some way or another, they won't be killed. Whether heavenly beings come and intervene, or all manner of things could prevent it, but they have that very powerful karma because of the previous actions that they've done. So the Buddha knows that this yaka can't split his heart. He knows that he can't be driven insane because he's enlightened, and that he couldn't be tossed across the ocean. So he says, okay, well, you can't do that, but still you can ask me a question. Ask whatever you want, friend. So then the Yaka Alavaka addressed the Blessed One in verse. He says, what here is a person's best treasure? What, well practiced, brings happiness? What is really the sweetest of tastes? How lives the one whose life they say is best? So first question, what is a person's best treasure? Second, what well-practiced brings happiness? Third, what is really the sweetest of tastes? And fourth, how lives the one whose life they say is best? So the Blessed One responds, faith is here a person's best treasure. The Dhamma, well practiced, brings happiness. Truth is really the sweetest of tastes. Living by wisdom, they say, one's life is best. So, one by one, we can think of these, even though each one is just a short phrase, it has a very deep meaning. So, the first question, the best treasure, Supreme Buddha says, faith is a person's best treasure. So when we think about treasure, we usually think about what? Money, right? Gold, gems. And those things are very nice, right? The Buddha doesn't deny. Those things are great. And when we when we have material wealth, when we have money, right? We can use that money to make more money in the present life. We can use that money to collect good karma, so we experience material happiness in future lives. But material wealth, as nice as it is and as useful as it can be, it doesn't really have anything to do with liberation. It doesn't really have anything to do with ending suffering. And in fact, most people, their wealth just ties them into more and more suffering. Right? But when we have confidence in the Buddha's teaching, then that can start many, many good things happening. And it can continue many good things happening. In other places, the Buddha talks about faith as a seed. Right? Seeds are very fragile. They don't seem very substantial. But when they're planted, when they're cultivated, they can grow into something very great, very useful. So when a person has developed this faith, this confidence that the Buddha knew what he was talking about, right? Then we can start to accumulate this spiritual wealth, this spiritual security, right? Because, you know, even just looking at this dynamic between material well-being and spiritual well-being, right? If a person doesn't have faith in karma, right, then all they value is the current material wealth. They don't think about, how can I benefit from this wealth in the future? They don't think, you know, is this wealth more important than acting in an ethical way, right? Many people, not everyone, but many people who become very wealthy, right, they just develop more and more greed for that material wealth. And they may even act in unethical ways, right? It's kind of crazy that sometimes these very wealthy people, they break laws to keep, you know, to keep their wealth, to protect their wealth, not understanding, right, karma and the results. So this is why the Buddha always talks about the importance of faith and confidence, right? Because if we don't have this, if we don't have this faith, then when it's difficult to practice his teachings, we can give up on it very easily. So the second question, what practice brings happiness? The Buddha says, the Dhamma, well practiced, brings happiness. So when we follow the Buddha's teachings, that's when we have the opportunity for real happiness. That when we make these changes in our lives, we're valuing the things that are really important to us, when we start to give up attachment to the things that we can't control, right? Then we start to really be the true owner of our happiness, right? It's not something fleeting. The third question, what is really the sweetest of tastes? And the Buddha says, truth is really the sweetest of tastes. So we can think about this in both levels, right? That when people are very honest with us, it's really nice, right? Especially when we start to value honesty, right? Value really knowing people's opinions of us, right? If we don't understand the whole big package, then someone criticizes us and our mind just goes crazy, right? Some people you don't even criticize them, but you say something and they take it as criticism, right? Someone says something that's true and they get offended. But when we understand this this practice of personal development in spiritual ways, then if someone points out our greediness or our anger or our cruelty, we're very happy with that kind of truth. It's strange in the world. People usually don't want to hear those things. But when our priorities are straight and when we value this spiritual development, then we love for people to point out. We try and love people to point out, right, our shortcomings, where we can improve. And then when it comes to the ultimate sense, the truth of the Buddha's teachings, right, then nothing can really compare with that. But if we don't have faith, then sometimes the truth can seem very bitter. So before this, before the chanting program tonight, there was a meditation class on the cemetery meditations, where we practice with the mind, remembering a dead body in the cemetery, a fresh dead body, just starting to swell up, and we remember a dead body that has pus oozing from it, and we remember a dead body that's just connected by sinews and veins, right? Always thinking, you know, this body of mine, it's going to be like that someday. It's of the same nature of that body. I don't have some special golden body that when I die it's going to, you know, stay here sweet smelling and, right? But thinking, yes, that horrible situation, that smelly dead body, this body of mine is the same way. Now, that's the truth, right? There's no getting around that. That's the truth. If you just go down the street in Winnipeg and start talking to people and explain that situation to them, are they going to say, ah, that's so sweet. That's the sweetest thing I've heard today, right? I can't believe that I haven't been thinking about this rotting body today. And my life would be so much better if I just had trained the mind to think in this way, right? We don't find that usually. Maybe we could, but generally we don't. It's a truth, but most people don't see that as something very sweet. Many people, you know, don't even want to go to a cemetery, let alone, you know, imagine what happens to this body. Right? They want to do everything they can to prevent that from happening, to keep it looking beautiful as long as possible. So this truth, right? When we really understand, it becomes very sweet, right? We can, if we're attached to this body, if we keep thinking, oh, you know, I see it's getting old, it's getting spotty, right? What can I do to fix that? Or, oh, you know, I was powerful because of my beauty when I was young, but now people ignore me, right? Or I had power over other people when I was young. I could use my good looks, my beauty to control people, right? And what do I have now? But if we're constantly training the mind in this truth that, yeah, we have it for a time, but it's not really ours, we have to let it go, right? Then as reality sets in, we don't get upset. We just think, yep, I knew the due date on this body, right? I knew when I'd have to return it back to the earth. You know, the book is due back to the library. Right? This body is due back to the earth. It's a normal thing. Right? And the last question. How lives the one whose life they say is best? And the Buddha says, living by wisdom, they say one's life is best. So we can see this kind of wraps together all these things, that when we lead our lives according to wisdom, not according to greed, not according to trying to get revenge, right? Even in this world, ordinary people can respect that good way of living. So then Alavaka asks another series of questions. He says, how does one cross the flood? How does one cross the sea? How does one overcome suffering? How is one fully purified? So this word flood in Pali is the word oga, and it has a very, very particular spiritual meaning. And it relates to samsara. So, in particular, the Buddha talks about four floods. The flood of sensual desire, the flood of being locked in this cycle of becoming, being bound to the karma that we've done in the past, that we're locked into this situation where our karma, previous karma, keeps causing us to be born again and again. The flood of wrong views and the flood of ignorance. That when, you know, when a flood happens, all the normal ways of acting are no longer safe. Some are not even possible, right? You can't use your car. Things get destroyed that you never imagine getting destroyed. And most of all, the water is very powerful. This is something that people who've been trapped in floods say, you know, I thought I could make it across the road, right? It only looked to be, you know, halfway up my body, but it was very powerful. I got knocked off my feet. The same is true for these floods of sensual desire, this flood of the cycle of rebirth, the way depending on wrong views, right, can really knock us off our feet. The way ignorance can wreak havoc in our lives. So the Buddha says, by faith, one crosses the flood. Right? Again, he talks about faith, that in this very dangerous flood, that confidence, that the Buddha knew what he was talking about. Right? That's what helps us cross through all these dangerous situations. Just thinking about sensual desire. Right? This is one of the key things that keeps people bound to the cycle of rebirth, right? Because sensual desires are great, right? And they're all around us, and they're tricky, right? They have this kind of inherent lie that once we get them, we'll be happy, but it doesn't really last. And so if someone tells us, oh no, this whole way that you've been looking at the world, thinking that I'll get my happiness through these material things. That's not true, right? That in fact, practicing renunciation, giving up our attachment to these things, is what's safe, right? It's very hard. It's very hard. Even people who have very strong faith in the Buddha's teachings still can be attached to these sensual desires. Even stream enterers, even once returners, right, still haven't completely given up this this bond of sensual desire. Then the next question, how does one cross the sea? And the Buddha says, by heedfulness, one crosses the sea. So the Buddha often uses sea just as a general term for samsara and talking about unenlightened beings being on this side of the sea and enlightened beings being on the other side. And he says, by heedfulness, appamada. So this this word heedfulness, appamada, has the very deep meaning of both not being lazy, not being not ignoring what we need to do, and also working hard, doing what we need to do. So this sea doesn't cross itself, right? Samsara doesn't put an end to itself. That it's through our effort, through working hard, that we can put these teachings into practice, right? Through looking at our experiences, through thinking about things like, did that thing that I wanted so badly really make me happy? Right? That's the kind of hard work that people have to do. That if anyone did that hard work, they might start to question, right? Is it really worth it for me to work so hard to get money so I can buy a house that I never have a chance to live in, that I can buy a car that I never have a chance to drive because I'm working so hard, right? If people just put a little bit of effort in that, they can start to see. How does one overcome suffering? And again, the Buddha says, by energy, one overcomes suffering. That if we don't have this energy, then we don't move forward on the path. And then the last question, how is one fully purified? And again, the Buddha says wisdom. By wisdom is one fully purified. So then Alavaka asks some questions that kind of have to do with more ordinary human life in this life. He asks, how does one gain wisdom? How does one find wealth? How does one achieve acclaim? How does one bind friends? And when passing away from this world to the next, how does one not sorrow? And so this question, how does one gain wisdom? And again, faith is the Buddha's first answer. He says, placing faith in the Dhamma of the Arahants for the attainment of Nibbana, one gains wisdom from a desire to learn if one is heedful and astute. So the Buddha always talks about faith as as the stepping stone to learning. That if we don't have some amount of faith, then we're not going to seek out these answers. We're not going to pay attention when words of wisdom are being spoken. Right? If we don't think that there's going to be some truth to it, if we don't have at least some amount of confidence, we don't seek those teachings out. So this is why it's so important that we protect this faith, right? People can people can damage their faith very easily, right? They read something that they don't understand or can't believe is possible, or they get in a fight with a monk, or they get somehow personally insulted by a monk, whether intentionally or not, right? And they say, ugh, you know, if that monk can act this way to me, then what good is this teaching, right? People can very quickly give up the confidence that they have. This is one of the reasons that the Buddha said we should never place our confidence in a person. He gave examples of if that person, if it's a monk, if that monk disrobes, and our confidence is based on that monk, right? Then what's going to happen? We're going to say, oh, what good was my confidence in that monk? How could that monk have taught me correct teachings when he himself couldn't even stick with the monk life? If the confidence is based on that monk, maybe the monk leaves, the Buddha said, or maybe the monk dies. Right? If your confidence is based on that individual, very shaky. So this is why we have to guard this faith, that when we read something that we don't understand, we can say, yeah, I don't understand that. There's a lot in the world that I don't understand. Right? Or I can't imagine how that would be true. Right? We can just say, yeah, I can't imagine how that would be true. Maybe I'll know later what that means, how I can use that teaching. How does one find wealth? The Buddha says, doing what is proper, dutiful. One with initiative finds wealth. So we have to work hard, right? If our previous karma hasn't landed us with wealthy parents, then we have to work hard in this life. One with initiative finds wealth. This is the commentaries bring up a really famous story from one of the Buddha's previous lives. Have you ever heard the story happened a few years ago of a guy who took a paperclip, a red paperclip, and decided that he would see how far he could get, like trading with someone, right, who really needed a paperclip and might be willing to trade for maybe a piece of paper or whatever? You've heard the story, right? What did he end up with? A house. A house. Somebody gave him a house. So the exact same thing happened in the life of the Buddha. Okay, not exact. It wasn't a paperclip. It was even worse. It was a dead mouse. It was a dead mouse. There was a banker. Must have been Benares. There was a banker, and he, as he was going through town, he, for some reason, decided to spout off a little bit of business advice. Even today, bankers like to do that. And as he was walking through this alley, he saw a dead mouse and said, you know, if somebody really has initiative, if somebody really works hard, they could even become wealthy with that dead mouse. And there was a beggar sitting next to that dead mouse. And these words went right to the beggar's heart, and he thought, could that really be possible? Let's see if that's true. And so he picked up the dead mouse. It must have been a fresh dead mouse. Picked up the dead mouse, and he found someone who owned a cat. And he said to that person, would you like some food for your cat? And they said, okay, I'll give you, you know, whatever the smallest, most worthless little coin was. And so he sold that, and I can't remember all the steps. It's a long series of steps and schemes. At one point, he gets some hakuru, some sugar, jaggery, some lumps of sugar, and he gathers some water and sells those to people collecting grain, people collecting straw, and barters for straw, and somehow through some conniving, like, negotiates with them to go on vacation for a day, and so on that day there was this big herd of horses coming through town, a horse seller, and there was no straw to be had except for this dead mouse guy. And so, you know, he works his way up until he becomes very wealthy. So this paperclip thing, it's kind of an ancient motif, which maybe you'd not believe unless you had heard this paperclip story and seen the guy's house. So, of course, this person was the bodhisattva, right? The Buddha before he attained enlightenment in a previous life. So, and this is, it's interesting because here the Buddha is showing just how much he knows about ordinary life. It's not that he's a spiritual teacher that only gives advice towards the ultimate spiritual goals, but that he knows exactly how the world works. He says, by truthfulness, one wins a claim. That when we're honest, this reputation spreads. He says, by giving, one binds friends. It's true, isn't it? We help people out, we give people things, and they want to stick around us. Right? He says, so the last question, when passing from this world to the next, how does one not sorrow? The Buddha says, the faithful seeker of the household life who possesses these four qualities, truth, dhamma, steadfastness, and generosity, does not sorrow when he passes on. So when we have all these good qualities, it leads to happiness in the future as well. Then the Buddha issues a challenge of his own to Alavaka, a very different kind of challenge. He says, come now, ask the others as well, the many ascetics and Brahmins, whether there exists here anything better than truth, self-control, generosity, and patience. So, as the Buddha predicted, while Alavaka was listening to this discourse, his heart changed. He was able to not only see that what the Buddha had to say was true, but his mind was completely transformed. He attained the first stage of enlightenment. So he says, he replies to the Buddha, he says, why now should I ask the many ascetics and Brahmins? Today I have understood the good pertaining to future lives. Indeed, it was for my sake that the Buddha came to stay at Alavi. Today I have understood where what is given bears great fruit. Now I will travel about from village to village, from city to city, paying homage to the Enlightened One and to the excellence of the Dhamma. Sad, sad, sad. So things worked out really well. Because this Yaka attained enlightenment, because he attained the first stage of enlightenment, gave up killing. And because the king was so happy to be out of this agreement, he made sure that people brought the yaka, things to eat, whatever the yaka would need. It worked out for the prince as well. He actually became a very famous disciple of the Buddha, Hattaka of Alavi, who was he eventually, in the human life, he attained non-returning and himself was able to give very deep discourses. We can read several of them in the Samyutta Nikaya. And, of course, word spread very quickly in Alavi about the change in situation, that there wasn't going to be this daily sacrifice. And not only that, but they were kind of inspired by the transformation that happened in Alavaka, that they went and sought out the Buddha. And because of that situation happening, 84,000 people came to the Buddha and also attained stream entry. So when we recite the qualities of the Buddha, the Etipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama Sambuddha, when we recite this quality of supreme trainer, of persons to be tamed, we have to think about this Alavaka, this Yaka who, you know, he was a bad dude. Like, he was not a good guy. He was very arrogant. He was violent even towards the Buddha. But yet, his mind was able to be changed by the Buddha. So when we, you know, as we've seen this practice, very difficult, right? There's many ways that we can think about giving up, think that that maybe someone else can, you know, someone who was born already with a very peaceful mind, right? They can really benefit from these teachings. But me, I'm always flopping around and I keep doing things that I regret, and right? If our mind starts to get caught up in those things, then we have to think, okay, even this Yaka, who for who knows how long had been eating all these people, right, who insulted the Buddha, who even threatened to kill the Buddha, right, that even a being with a mind like that can be transformed. Maybe it can happen to me, right? Maybe if I protect this faith, that little by little, I'll be able to make these same sorts of changes in my life. So, having had the chance to learn these beautiful verses that the Buddha preached about benefits in this life, benefits in future lives, and especially the benefit of maintaining this confidence that we ourselves have gained through practicing the teachings, right? For most of us, we don't come to this place unless we've investigated the teachings, seen, yeah, these are true to the extent that I can see. I've tried these things out, and as best as I could, I see how they're beneficial. Right? So we've developed this faith, and now we remember the great importance of protecting them. So, having heard this story about the Supreme Buddha's ability to train even the most violent of minds, may we keep these teachings in mind, may we investigate them thoroughly, may we remember them, may we fully put them into practice in our lives. And through the power of this good karma, may we one day ourselves experience the supreme bliss of Nibbana in this Gautama Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.